Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's been almost a year since National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden's revelations about U.S. data gathering were reported to the world. First, we learned of the collection of phone records. Then we learned that internet traffic was being monitored as well. A new documentary takes a look at the story and sheds light on the role tech giants such as Google, Facebook, and Yahoo played in NSA spying. PBS's Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets, Part 2, Privacy Lost, airs tonight. Joining us now by phone is documentary producer Martin Smith. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Thank you.
So two NSA programs are outlined in the documentary, PRISM and Muscular. Can you give us a thumbnail on each and how they differed?
One of the first revelations from the Snowden documents was of this secret program codenamed PRISM. The companies themselves didn't know it by that name, and certainly none of the employees or engineers in Silicon Valley knew it by that name. So they were blindsided by the revelation. But essentially, it allows the government to come to Google or Facebook or Yahoo or Microsoft and make a request. And it varies depending on the company. They put information that's requested in a Dropbox, or they give them a thumb drive, or whatever it is. But they provide this information to the government. Only very few people at the companies would know about it. They need top-level security clearance. So maybe a lawyer, maybe somebody else knows about it. But it is a sort of front-door operation, but it was run secretly. And so it was a big surprise to employees in Silicon Valley and even many of the executives who hadn't heard about it. Now, the other program, Muscular, is very different in that this is where the government goes overseas and taps into, in this particular case, the lines linking data centers of Google and Yahoo and simply steals or takes the information without the company's knowledge. So it's a backdoor operation. And this was extremely infuriating to Silicon Valley because they thought they had this other relationship. But in fact, when that didn't work for the NSA, they went overseas where U.S. surveillance laws don't restrict them in the same ways that they do domestically and simply took the data.
What role did the Patriot Act play in the emergence of these programs and in the growth of NSA spying?
Well, it was essential because it was the Patriot Act signed in October of 2001 that completely it reinvigorated the NSA's methods. And so the PRISM program doesn't really take off until starting in 2007. But before that, you had warrantless wiretapping, and there was evidence of them tapping into data lines of the Internet here in the United States. And the use of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, the FISA court, and the use of national security letters by the FBI, who does the legwork of the intelligence agencies here in the United States, boomed. It went through the roof. Between 2003 and 2006, according to the Justice Department, there were close to 200,000 national security letters, many of them with gag orders. These are letters delivered to individuals that are told that they have to turn over their user information. And a company like Google receives thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these in a given year. And there's no evidence that until 2013 that any of the large internet companies fought back. And that was a Patriot Act. I mean, these NSLs existed before, but they weren't used as freely as they were after the Patriot Act was signed.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Martin Smith. He's the producer for PBS's Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets, Part 2, Privacy Lost, which airs tonight. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When you say only the people at the very top of these companies knew about this and that most people were very surprised. I'm trying to figure out how that works. Is it that simple? Is that few people need to know in order to get access to that much information?
I guess the answer is yes. I think it's a very good question, and I ask this of a number of people. One of the problems we ran into here in producing this three-hour series, people in government spoke, former officials at the NSA, even current officials at the NSA. But inside Silicon Valley companies, no one would talk to us. So we had to figure things out from the outside, talking to former executives or employees. This is, first of all, many of them have gag orders, and many of them are worried about going public with information about a secret government program. But in terms of your question as to how many people have to know about it, you would think that a few engineers would have to know and that it would, you know, the word would get out. But in fact, all my conversations, and I talked to some attorneys that were hired to handle some of these requests, and they concurred that only very few people, sometimes one or two people at a large internet company, would have to know about the request, and they would be able to somehow fulfill the request, the ongoing request, without anybody else learning of it.
Is this still going on?
Yes. As far as we know, there's no. And in fact, when the government was, when President Obama put together a panel to review all these programs, there were a number of criticisms. The phone metadata program was called fairly useless, that it didn't really stop anything, and there were calls for reform. The use of the national security letters was criticized as abusive and out of control, and the gag orders that came with them should be looked at. But in terms of PRISM, there was programs like that were basically they basically said those programs do help in ferreting out terrorist attacks. Now, we always have a problem here in that we don't really, because of the reticence to give up sources and methods, the NSA can't really point to particular incidents where these things have worked. But the review panel had presumably access to secret information and did assess that those programs worked.
One point that was made in the documentary was that the NSA just wanted access to what companies like Google were already doing for advertising purposes. Can you tell us about the information that they wanted and what Google, for example, gave them that they already had?
Well, Google is an advertising company. 95% of its revenue comes from advertising or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they do that by knowing their customer, and knowing your customer is essentially a form of commercial surveillance for advertising purposes. So they collect information on you, they build a dossier on you, all of them do this, and then they use that information to go to advertisers and provide them opportunities. So they're engaged in a form of surveillance, and the government, of course, noticed this. And the kind of data troves that we're seeing collected in these large data centers by these big internet companies is something never seen before in history, the amount of information that's there. And the government, of course, couldn't resist and felt that if terrorists are communicating with these tools, they had to have access to them. So the information is anything you can imagine. It's emails, it's text messages, it's web chats, it's browsing histories, and more that are collected, stored by these large companies.
Why does the FBI and the NSA love Facebook? Is Facebook part of this?
Facebook is very much part of this because there were claims of by the companies that they were anonymizing all the data that they were collecting mm-hmm. and using for commercial purposes. Now, we could go into anonymization, which is a complicated subject in and of itself. But once Facebook came along, Facebook knows your name, knows who you are, and knows. And I think what people don't realize is that these companies are tracking you even when you're not on their websites. And so Facebook initiated what people term the data wars in Silicon Valley. When Google noticed how well Facebook was doing in sort of cracking a new kind of interaction on the internet, they realized they had to ramp up their efforts to collect information. And this leads to a kind of arms race for more and more data, because who has the most data wins in this advertising game. So Facebook adds a sort of a de-anonymized interaction with the internet that is extremely useful for law enforcement or intelligence agencies.
So to what extent, what do we know about how much Facebook hands over on any given person?
Well, tens of thousands of requests come into these companies in a given year. We don't know yet exactly on a given person how much they're giving up. They're, by law, restricted to looking at foreign targets, but they can look at a foreign target's communications three steps out with other people. And so in this process, a lot of information gets swept up. And as I mentioned in the programs like Muscular, where you're tapping overseas data lines, there's really no restriction on how much they can collect. And the internet works much like if you have a computer at home and a computer at your office and a mobile device. They're all syncing in the cloud. Every time you make a change at home, it syncs up so that it's available to you at your office. And just multiply that out by all the data servers that are all over the planet. Every time you make a change in one, it syncs up everywhere. So all your information is going around and being sunk up, if you will, everywhere. So when you're tapping an overseas data line, you're collecting a lot of information on Americans as well.
Now, you mentioned that Silicon Valley, you know, the rank and file there were enraged over this. What's really happened since then? You said the programs are still going on. Are people still angry but suffering through it, angry all the way to the bank or what?
Well, the Muscular program is facing the Muscular program where they're tapping overseas data lines is facing some obstacles because the companies are now racing to improve their encryption. Some companies had a better record on encryption than others. Google had a pretty good record, but even they had left major data lines unencrypted. Yahoo had a particularly bad record of not even encrypting the communications between you and them. So when you sent an email, it went on their lines unencrypted. They are racing now to improve encryption and to protect the privacy of their users. On the other hand, the PRISM program, there is a legitimate reason for law enforcement, if they have a real target, to want to collect information. The question is whether or not they should be able to do that without court approval. Mm-hmm. And the way in which both the FISA court operated and the NSL programs worked, there was really not so much oversight as you would like, as most people may have assumed.
Martin Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Martin Smith, he's the producer for PBS's Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets, Part 2, Privacy Loss, that airs tonight on WOSU Television. Tech Tuesday will continue when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Federal Communications Commission voted on two issues that will impact how we consume data. One has net neutrality advocates concerned about the future of the internet, and the other could affect the choices we have when it comes to mobile plans. Joining us now by phone from the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. is reporter Alan Holmes. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Thank you for having me back.
Let's start with the vote that advocates of net neutrality have them so concerned. How did the FCC vote there?
Well, it got pretty complicated, but basically what Chairman Tom Wheeler did was he is reacting to the court decision earlier this year when Verizon sued the FCC over its previous net neutrality rules, saying they didn't have the authority to act in keeping ISPs from blocking or slowing down traffic, or basically what they call managing their networks. And the court sided with Verizon, but they also gave the FCC a little bit of a roadmap on how to, if they're going to follow net neutrality, they may go about it. And it's a little bit of legalese, but they said, why don't you look at what Section 706 of the 1996 Telecommunications Act. What basically Tom Wheeler did was he proposed some rules saying that he's going to, you know, follow Section 706, which would allow them to manage broadband internet connections based on deployment and competition. And it would allow, let's say, Netflix to buy a pay Comcast or AT&T and Verizon for a fast lane, so-called fast lane, to their customers. And what net neutrality supporters got very upset about this. They thought that this is basically a two-tiered system. Fast, if you can afford the fast lane, you get the fast lane. But for everybody else, you're going to have a slower lane. So there was a huge uproar here in Washington. There were people camped out in front of FCC offices. There's been over 3 million comments and phone calls and petitions to the FCC. And so what Tom Wheeler said, okay, well, we will consider what is called Title II, which is basically regulation. They would regulate the ISPs as phone carriers, typical telephone carriers. And so what they did, what they passed was that, okay, we're considering all these options. We'll accept comments on them, and then we will close the comment period this summer in July, and then we're going to write the rules and vote on them later this month. So that's where we are. Everything's still on the table, and he basically, Tom Wheeler basically backtracked a little bit and said, okay, I will include more chances for regulation.
So anyone who sat around and tried to watch Netflix and have it keep stopping and adjusting knows what the problem is with the amount of data that has to be downloaded, and that they need a faster lane to do it as fast as we've gotten used to having everything appear on our screens these days. Is that the argument in favor of these fast lanes?
That's exactly right. Yes. Now, you know, there's a lot of variables that go into if you're watching Netflix and all of a sudden it freezes and you see the spinning circle and you're waiting to reload. It could be that there's just a lot of traffic on the internet at that time of night. Mostly, you know, I think about 40% of all traffic right around 8 p.m. at night is from Netflix on the internet. But it could be too much traffic. It has to do with your speed of your internet. And there have been concerns that some of these ISPs have been doing something that's called throttling, that they've actually slowed the service down from Netflix to force them to the negotiating table to pay for the direct access. Now, there's Netflix has said this, that we're being throttled and being forced to pay for the direct connection, but the ISPs deny this. Now, right now, they have they're paying for direct access to Comcast customers and direct access to Verizon customers now. So you may expect to see more, but that's where we are right now.
When it comes to this public comment period, what are the various stakeholders that are going to weigh in on this?
Oh, that's a lot of people. Basically, you have the advocacy groups here in town, like the Free Press, the New America Foundation, Public Knowledge. They're very much common cause, very much behind net neutrality. They're whipping up support from individuals, businesses. You also have also on that site is Google, Facebook, Netflix, Amazon. All want an open internet so they don't have to pay for access, as you know, Google's moving into Google TV. So they want they don't want to have to pay these higher prices. On the other side are going to be the internet service providers, you know, Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, Time Warner Cable, and others. Most on their side is are mostly Republicans, and on the net neutrality side are mostly Democrats. So it's going to be a lot of comments and a lot of accusations back and forth, and reports being filed, economic studies, everything.
Now, we're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest is Alan Holmes. He's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C., and we're talking about the issue of net neutrality by way of the FCC, which is opening up a public comment period now on new rules that they'll start writing in later in the summer. The issue, Netflix is so common, it's easy to talk in terms of Netflix. What Netflix is saying is, we have to do this. We can't provide our service without more access. We're willing to pay for it. The problem is that there may be other competition coming up behind them that has the same problems but doesn't have the wealth to compete with them. Okay.
That's exactly right. That's what they're saying, is that, you know, what about the next Netflix? What about the next Google that is going to need "quote unquote" fatter pipes, you know, a lot of, I guess you could say, a lot of lanes in the highway to get through their information, because we don't know, is, you know, that's what they're worried about, is that if Google and Netflix had to pay a tremendous amount of money up front to get on these networks and to customers, they might not have been gotten off the ground in the first place. Venture capitalists are kind of worried about this as well, that, you know, they're going to, you know, it may dampen innovation and investments in new tech startups.
Another issue that's gotten less attention is a vote on the rules for auctions where wireless companies bid on frequencies. Tell us,
sure,
if this auction process is new and what it's all about and how the FCC voted.
Okay, yeah. They had a full agenda on May 15th, yeah. And this is one of the items. Basically, what they're doing is they're trying to induce broadcast television stations that are in the so-called 600 megahertz range to sell back their spectrum to the FCC, which will then, the FCC will turn it around and sell it most likely to the wireless companies, T-Mobile, Sprint, AT&T, Verizon, so that they can have more spectrum, more radio signals to meet the demand of all these tablets and smartphones coming online and you know, really pulling down information wirelessly. Now, what they did is that AT&T and Verizon own most of this. It's 600 megahertz is in what's called the low band spectrum. It's really nice spectrum because it travels very long distances. It goes through buildings very nicely. AT&T and Verizon have about 3/4 of this low band spectrum. So if, the fear is if they get more, they're going to dominate the market and push out any competitors. T-Mobile and Sprint say they need it to be able to build out a more robust nationwide network to better compete. So the FCC put together this fairly complicated plan that would put in reserve, if after certain levels were met that everybody could bid on, then this extra spectrum, if they get this extra spectrum, they're just going to put it in reserve. And basically, the rules that they would use would allow just T-Mobile and Sprint and, you know, U.S. Cellular and some other smaller wireless companies to bid on that, and AT&T and Verizon would not be allowed to bid on that. And the rules, some of the advocacy groups were they were a little disappointed. They think they should have been more aggressive. They don't think the rules are going to really help T-Mobile and Sprint out a whole lot. So they're thinking that AT&T and Verizon basically got what they wanted. They didn't get everything. They wanted no rules and wanted everything open to bid, but they think they basically got what they're going to want. It's going to be hard for T-Mobile and Sprint to get enough spectrum to be able to compete, although the FCC would argue otherwise, I'm sure.
Is this more about spectrum and less about money? How much money is changing hands for all of this?
There's the Congressional Budget Office estimated that about 20 the FCC could raise about $27 billion in the auction, and that's supposed to go. They're supposed to use that for deficit reduction and building a nationwide first responder network, radio network, that all first responders would use the same frequency in responding to emergencies. So it is about money. The FCC has to raise money to satisfy the statutory requirements. They think they can do that. AT&T said they'll spend probably in between $9 to $18 billion on the spectrum, and in their latest proposal, where on Sunday they said that they wanted to buy DirecTV. One of the concessions they're going to give is say that they promised to spend $9 billion on the spectrum auction if they're allowed to buy DirecTV. So it's a little bit of a enticement to the FCC to approve that merger.
Right. I wondered if that was connected. Yeah. The vote was along, before we get to that, I want to talk about DirecTV and AT&T. But first, the vote was along party lines. What does that tell us?
Well, the two Republican commissioners are adamantly opposed to putting any restrictions on spectrum or any regulation of net neutrality. And they were... they were pretty vociferous. They used fairly strong language in opposing this. And then the three Democrats, which includes Tom Wheeler, who was appointed by President Obama, are much more in favor of regulation and limiting the amount of spectrum that Verizon, AT&T can get in the hopes that they can increase competition, which will keep prices low. So anytime, it depends on the FCC, who controls the commission. The FCC depends on who's in the White House, because there's always two Republicans, always two Democrats who are appointed. And then the chairman is appointed by whoever the president is. So you have a Republican president, you're going to have a Republican commissioner, and you'll have three Republicans on there. Right now we have a Democratic president, so we have three Democrats on the commission.
Is the Republican opposition to the regulation of the spectrum just because they're based on free market philosophy?
Yes, and also based on the fact that they get a tremendous amount of campaign contributions,
right,
from Verizon and AT&T, Comcast, and every other telecommunications company. That the Republicans tend to get a little bit more. The Democrats get some, but the Republicans tend to get a little bit more.
Yeah, if they can drop $9 billion pretty much at the drop of the hat, they probably can spend a little bit on lobbying, too.
Yeah, they spend about $18 million on lobbying, AT&T, so you can pretty much sure that's a drop in the bucket.
Another big story, we talked about it briefly, the purchase of DirecTV by AT&T. It's not clear that it's actually going to happen, but they've been talking and they want to. It comes as we wait to see if the Time Warner Comcast merger will be approved. What will the impact of all these mergers have on consumers?
And that's exactly what the FCC is going to look at. Now, for the AT&T and DirecTV merger, AT&T doesn't really compete with DirecTV for basically you call it cable TV services. They overlap a little bit, but not a whole lot. So everybody's thinking that that's probably going to go through. And now DirecTV does not provide broadband internet connections through their satellite. So AT&T sees that as an opportunity. But really, the people believe that AT&T's purchase of DirecTV is more of a defensive move to the Comcast Time Warner Cable purchase. Right now, everybody's scrambling to find ways to make more money because the pay TV and wireless subscriptions are flattening out. And what's really expanding business is streaming video. So if you don't have an opportunity to stream video, then your growth potential isn't going to be there. So this is much more of a defensive move on AT&T's part rather than really trying to find ways of providing new products or being innovative. That's basically the feeling among analysts.
Most of us will have fewer choices.
Yes, but they would argue that since they don't compete directly in these markets, this is what Comcast says about Time Warner Cable. They don't overlap at all. So you know that the choices will remain the same. But the question is if you there's going to be fewer cable companies to negotiate with if you're a content provider. So it gives them more of a leverage and pushing down how much, let's say, ESPN or Netflix asks to be carried.
Alan Holmes, thanks for joining us again today. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Alan Holmes, he's a reporter at the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Coming up, more Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We know sites like Facebook and Google monitor our data so they can display specific advertising aimed at our interests and maybe dish it up to the federal government, too. If you post about a new baby, for example, you may start seeing more ads for cribs and strollers. But if you don't want the internet knowing your business and shooting those ads your way, it may not be possible to take that information back. Huffington Post tech reporter Bianca Bosker has written about her own experience trying to erase something from the internet. She joins us now to talk about it. Bianca Bosker, welcome back.
Thank you.
And I guess I should say best wishes on your engagement, because it was news of your engagement that started this.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was not so smart as to try and hide the news from the internet to begin with, because, I mean, really, you do want people to know you're getting
right.
married. I mean, that's and they will know at some point. What I did not anticipate, however, was the total deluge of advertising that would take over every page I visited on the internet. I mean, it became this inescapable bridal expo pitching me everything from wedding workouts to stationery that were not only irrelevant, but also felt very intrusive. Call me, I don't know, rain on a parade, but I still think of it as being a very kind of intimate affair, and it felt very commercialized to try and turn this into, just an excuse for a shopping spree. So yeah, I tried to figure out, could I induce selective internet amnesia and make the online advertisers of the web forget this little bit about my life?
Could you just delete the Facebook post?
If only it was that easy. So the first thing I tried to do is basically figure out who knew what, and I identified three major camps. So Facebook, Google, and then the kind of third-party, wedding service providers, everyone from, Bloomingdale's I registered with to David's Bridal, where I try on a wedding dress, to these data brokers with whom other companies might have shared information. You can opt out of targeted advertising, but that doesn't erase the underlying information, which is what I was after.
Mm-hmm.
And changing your Facebook, what I ultimately tried to do is kind of got in touch with all these companies, tracked down what the data brokers knew about me, which they were not at all forthcoming about, figured out that a lot of these companies, I thought David's Bridal was a dressmaker. Little did I know that when I tried on this gown, I had signed up for their privacy policy, which actually lets them share my information with basically anyone they want. So trying to go and extricate that information, it's impossible almost to figure out who even has it, let alone trying to delete it.
What do you mean you signed a privacy policy?
Well, so you sort of, when you sign up for their services, you basically implicitly have to agree to their privacy policy, sort of like when you use, Facebook or Google. So the Knot.com or David's Bridal, you know, by using their services, you implicitly agree to abide by their policies, which gives them the flexibility to basically share your information with their wedding services and sort of network of quote-unquote trusted partners. So what I ultimately tried to do is, if you can't delete, deceive. So my next approach was, if I can't actually erase this information, maybe I can fool the internet into thinking I'm not getting married. I'm actually single and ready to mingle. So I actually joined basically as many online dating sites as I possibly could and began downloading lots of different dating apps and logging in with my Facebook account and trying to confuse Google, Facebook, and the various data brokers into thinking that I was either a very confused bride or a recently ditched one.
Uh-huh. What happened?
So I managed, didn't take too much. I was able to convince Google that one of my interests was personals and dating. So Google has a site, anyone can visit, called Ad Settings, where you can basically see what Google thinks it knows about you and your interests. So that was something I used as sort of barometer to say, does Google now believe that I'm interested in dating? And I was able to induce that. In Gmail, for example, the ads for dream romance getaways for the honeymoon turned into, I'm not even joking here, quote unquote, is he cheating? Background check services. Facebook, though, I have to say, Facebook, I have changed my status to single. I have made my fiance change his status to single. I've joined online dating sites with my Facebook profile, and I'm still seeing the wedding stationery ads. So they seemed to be very they seem to be very clued into what's actually going on. In part because they actually do get data from third party data brokers as well to help inform,
like perhaps David's Bridal.
Yeah, right, or something like Axiom or Datalogix or okay. Epsilon. There's a huge number, maybe almost 50 companies that Facebook uses to kind of fill out what it knows about you and help advertisers reach specific demographics.
You mentioned with Google, you can go to the ad settings and find out what Google thinks
yep.
it knows about you. How do you get there?
So I believe it's just google.com/settings/ads or google.com/ads/settings.
Uh-huh.
But anyone with a Gmail account can see what it knows based on your search pattern and what it knows based on the websites you visit. If you're not interested in having Google or anyone else tracking you around the web, there are a number of different tools you can install. So, for example, Disconnect makes a couple great ones, and Abine as well, A-B-I-N-E, that basically mask your searches so Google doesn't know what IP address they're coming from, and also basically stop the cookies that allow data brokers and other companies to track you around the web. So if you've ever seen an ad for shoes show up on the New York Times or HuffPost mm-hmm. or something after looking for shoes, this would stop them from being able to connect to your activity.
I see a lot of shoe ads, actually. It's my weakness, I think. The European Union Court recently ruled in a case involving Google that users have a right to be forgotten. What was that about?
Right. So basically, privacy laws are generally more stringent in the EU than they are here in the States. And basically, the court upheld that Google needed to give people a way to request links to information about them be deleted from their search results. So to explain that a little more clearly, let's say you typed in, Bianca Bosker, and you found some awful links about an arrest, or this is all hypothetical, but an arrest or a divorce or something that was no longer relevant or that you didn't want to have show up there. There has to be some burden of proof, I believe. They won't just take it down automatically. Mm-hmm. But the court ruled that Google has to give people a way to delete those search results. Unfortunately, that isn't something that exists here yet. But it does help solve that problem a bit of, giving the internet some selective amnesia.
Why, let me ask you, why it bothered you to be getting all of this wedding stuff? Was it just, were you inundated? Is it, well, must be a huge industry.
It's a huge industry. According to the wedding industry, the average wedding now costs about $30,000. So, you know, brides-to-be are incredibly valuable. And so they just really try and seize on that golden window to make a big buck out of you. But more than that, I think the issue is not so much I'm trying to hide being married or engaged. I mean, again, that's not something I want to hide from the world. I'm very happy about it. But what bothered me was also the fact that it's very black and white with our privacy these days. There's no real control over where what you share ends up. So once you share something or make something known, it becomes fair game for the entire world and network of advertisers, companies, social networks to know about. And so the idea that there's no selective disclosure is something that I find uncomfortable. It's either private and it's secret, or it's out there and there's nothing in between. So, you know, personal information, it used to be this idea that, you know, kind of personal information was something you shared at your own disclosure, right? You maybe wouldn't tell someone the first time you met them. Now personal information in the age of big data and social networking has come to mean anything about you you haven't kept hidden. And I think that this experiment made me very aware of that, because I don't necessarily want these companies that don't know me to know that I am engaged. Why is it any of their business?
Mm-hmm.
Except it is their business. It is literally their business to know what's going on in my life and sell me anything they can.
Right. Michael in Cincinnati, you are on the air with Bianca Bosker from the Huffington Post. Hi, Michael.
Hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I had a little bit of a quick comment. If whatever web browser you're using, whether it be Internet Explorer or Google Chrome, if you set your setting on your browser to just wipe out all your cookies and browser history, whenever you shut your browser down, that takes out about 75% of what companies like that are doing.
So that is something, yeah, that I did do, is wipe out, you know, if you erase your cookies, yes, that absolutely is a big, big help. But that doesn't, you know, get rid of, for example, you know, Facebook, if I change my profile to engaged, that's still sitting in sort of Facebook server somewhere. I mean, wiping out my cookies doesn't change that bit of information.
Okay, Michael.
But you're right that it's definitely a great, great first step to take.
Thank you, Michael, for the call. An email from David. He asks, was your guest interested in using software that would block ads? If so, was it effective?
That's also a great question. So, you know, as I mentioned before, I was not so interested. So blocking ads is one thing. And I think as someone that writes for an ad-supported site, I think sometimes the ethics of, you know, you know, we sort of pay for free things by enduring some of the ads. So, you know, blocking all of the ads, maybe a bit extreme, wasn't something I personally thought about. But I did, because again, I was more interested in this idea of just erasing that information, of taking back that information. But as I mentioned before, I didn't want to just do non-targeted ads, because it is possible to still see advertising, but just ask that advertisers not target you based on who you are. That I didn't want to do, again, doesn't solve the underlying erasure issue. And it just results in sort of more annoying, totally irrelevant advertising.
the other poll.
Also a great question, because that is possible.
Switching gears now from things you want to keep private to things you want to promote. You recently wrote about the culture of the hashtag. Just tell us again, you know, for those who are unfamiliar, what the hashtag is used for in social media.
Right. So some of us might be more familiar with the number symbol that appears
on
your telephone.
Or the pound mark. Or pound,
yeah, the pound, right, just to the right of the zero on your phone. And so that started off as a way to let content be searchable on sites like Twitter. So Twitter was really, you know, went hand in hand with the rise of the hashtag. So if you wanted people to follow a particular event or issue, you could use a hashtag like hashtag social media, hashtag hashtag State of the Union, and people could click on that and find all tweets that contain that hashtag. It's since evolved to be much more, its use has ranged in everything from kind of snide commentary emoticon type usage to, as I argue in this piece, a kind of sloganizing purpose, so something that takes a phrase and turns it into a slogan for a larger movement.
Yeah, someone once hashtagged with my name, Ugg.
Ugg? That's not very nice.
Yeah, it wasn't very nice, but, you know, that's the way it goes in the business.
Right. It's sort of like an emoticon, right? Instead of for some reason, I think it's a cue to people that read it that it's supposed to be a kind of, add some nuance or color to whatever they're saying.
Yeah, you wrote that hashtags are the raised fist of punctuation. I love that. I love it. What did you mean by it?
So I was talking about specifically in the context of, Bring Back Our Girls, which is a hashtag that has since faded a bit, but was, being very, very widely used and tweeted in connection with the kidnapping of, 200 schoolgirls. And so I was talking about this idea that, people are using hashtags in places where they don't really serve a clear function, right? They're putting it on T-shirts, on book covers, in photographs. You can't click on them. They don't need to be there. But we use them because the hashtag signals that this phrase is, first of all, a motto, that it's a slogan for something. Second of all, that it should be shared and shared now. And third, that it's something to get involved with. So I think, the hashtag, in a way, it's almost like this online body language that conveys something more about what you're sharing. So I think, you see this with also Girl Boss is another example I use, which is the title of a book. And the book is not just called Girl Boss. It's called Hashtag Girl Boss, which turns it from just a title to, again, a movement. It's trying to get people involved. It's saying, see this, share this, and spread the word.
When did hashtags take on this role?
That's a good question. I think, don't know an exact date, but I think, we've seen it, get this reputation for something that's a political cause following the hashtag's use around the elections, I believe, in Iran, in some of the uprisings that we saw going on in the Arab world. So that's where it took on a bit of this connection of, hashtag isn't just a way of organizing information. It's not just a way of adding nuance to a phrase, but it's more of a political tool as well.
And people use them a lot on Twitter now. It's pretty common to organize things by hashtag.
Yes, all over. I mean, yeah. Twitter, Instagram, yeah. Facebook introduced hashtags. And again, people are, but they've moved off of the web and into the physical world as well. You see them on T-shirts, again, books, and in photographs. I mean, some of these photographs, for example, were people took photos of themselves holding up handwritten signs that said hashtag bring back our girls. They could have just said bring back our girls. They didn't need the hashtag to be there, but people put it there. So I was interested in examining, why that is. And again, I think another purpose of it is really to turn it from a phrase into a slogan.
Now, someone's asking me if I've seen the Jimmy Fallon hashtag videos.
Oh, man.
What are those?
Oh, it's great. It's a great video. I believe it's a Justin Timberlake that's making
I love Justin Timberlake.
Fun of, this tendency to throw hashtags on everything.
Yeah.
So they basically they speak in hashtags, and they try and point out how ridiculous it is to use hashtags as a suffix to every phrase.
I've just been told hashtag 1 minute left. That means Bianca Bosker, I have to say thanks to you. And once again, best wishes for every happiness in your new marriage coming up.
Thanks so much.
Bianca Bosker, she's a Huffington Post tech reporter. Thanks for listening to today on Tech Tuesday. The AllSides staff deserves thanks as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Olivia Rojas, Justin English, Emmy Beach, Julia Hyder, and Leticia Wiggins. Thank you all. Couldn't do it without you. Video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks again for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.